Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored and listened to around the world via podcast, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for the webpage where you can find more resources, past episodes, the book, the conference, and all kinds of other good stuff, including, of course, links to the YouTube video channel where you'll find today's show available via video as well. So do go and get subscribed over at the YouTube channel if you're not already, and you can watch the video. Very exciting edition of the program today. Super interesting topic on healing and disability. But before I get to introduce my guests, a reminder that we're now just 3 weeks away from Unbelievable, the Conference 2019, Speaking Truth in a Post-Truth World, brought to you in partnership with Biola Apologetics and ADF International. And a little later on in today's show, I'm going to be speaking to Craig Hazen, who's heading up the team from Biola Apologetics. He'll be speaking on the person of Jesus, why the good news is much better than the fake news. So hear my conversation with Craig a little later on in today's show. It's been great to be able to feature so many people who are speaking at this year's conference on the show over the last several weeks. We've obviously had shows with ADF International when Ryan Christopher, and last week, of course, Lawrence Wilkinson joined me debating Israel Folau and his sacking from Rugby Australia. And a bit further back, Christy Mayer also joined us, of course. She's going to be great at this year's conference, talking about the whole concept of truth. And really looking forward as well to Krish Kandaya on how to create better conversations. In fact, in just a couple of weeks' time, Krish is on the show in conversation with agnostic listener Tom Newman. So look out for that in your podcast feed and on your radio as well. And some of the speakers who are flying in for the conference, I'll be making sure to catch some time with them to record editions of Unbelievable while they're over as well. People like Bruxy Cavey and others. So do look out for more content from the speakers in your podcast feed and on your radio set in weeks to come. But if you're not yet booked in for Saturday the 20th of July, can I encourage you to go over to the website and do so? It's great to know that you're planning on coming. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable conference, and you can check out all of the speakers, all of the topics, and the ticket deals as well. There's a group deal, a student discount, and if you buy two or more tickets, you get last year's conference on DVD free. So again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable conference.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the program, we're asking, do Christians need to rethink disability and healing? Damon Rose joins me on the show. He's a BBC presenter and producer who's blind and recently produced a radio documentary titled Pick Up Your Stretcher and Walk. It, along with an accompanying article, Stop Trying to Heal Me, raised the whole question of whether Christians should be offering prayer for healing for those with disabilities. Now, Damon himself isn't a Christian, and he'll be bringing his perspective as someone from outside the faith, as it were. But Reverend Zoe Hemmings is a Christian and featured in the documentary as an ordained priest and wheelchair user. She believes Christians do need to rethink their approach to disability theology and suggests that it's possible disability may even be part of who we are in heaven too. Also joining us on the show is the Reverend Ian Paul, theologian who wrote a response blog to that BBC article in which he critiques the idea from some disability theologians that God is disabled, and one assertion in the article that the Gospels use disabled peoples as a sort of prop to magnify Jesus' supernatural abilities. So we're going to be asking, are miracle healing claims disrespectful even to those with disabilities? And is disability something we might take with us into the kingdom come? Welcome along to the programme, Damon, Zoe and Ian. Great to have you all joining me on the
show
today.
Hello.
Great to have you. Let's start with yourself, Damon, because it was really your programme and article that really made me want to have this sort of a discussion here on the show. Mm. I saw particularly the article being shared by so many of my friends on Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere, Christians who were sharing this and saying, what an interesting, thought-provoking article, essentially. Do you want to tell us, though, where the documentary, really, that the article was based on came from in the first place?
Well, that's, I was going to say that was great. And the fact that it has been shared so widely is fantastically satisfying to somebody who makes programmes. I've been doing programmes around disability and a website called Ouch, which is a... how would I put it? It's a disability website, for want of another way of putting it.
In a nutshell, yeah.
In a nutshell. How did we come up with the idea? We were sitting in the office one day, and I think I brought up the subject that I had been approached by a Christian who wanted to heal me.
This was just in public... That you were approached by someone you'd obviously never met before.
That's right. And I was quite surprised because when I lost my sight, I went to boarding school for blind kids, and I have a lot of blind friends and disabled friends. And it's a big thing in our community. You know, we know if someone says, "Oh, got a Christian come up to me the other day," you know, they're like, "Oh God, they understand. They understand what I mean by that."
You're not alone in this particular. The fact that you've been approached randomly by people wanting to pray for you.
Yeah. Whereas in the office, none of my colleagues, none of whom are disabled, knew anything about this, and they were quite shocked, horrified that someone would jump into my life, take my attention away, and want to try and heal me. Even though they didn't know me, they thought it was presumptuous. They thought it was a bit unpleasant, rude, and that is, I guess, that is how I feel. You know, when I'm walking down the street, quite happy, just trying to get to the shop, and somebody stops me. And says, "Have you ever heard of Jesus?" Which, of course, I've heard of Jesus. You just start thinking to yourself, "Oh goodness me, they're going to heal me." They think very little of me.
Right.
They assume that I must have a terrible life and that it needs fixing.
You say this in both the article and the documentary, that it feels a bit like when people ask you, "Can I pray for you for healing?" It's like you're being seen as a sort of project that needs fixing in that way, and you'd find that somewhat disrespectful of your personal dignity, that sort of thing.
I've been singled out as someone who must need help and who must need, I guess, a miracle or something to get over what I am.
In that sense, the fact that, you know, you're blind, and I'm sure you're probably often accompanied by a guide dog and so on, and there's a sense in which your disability is quite obviously visible in that sense, whereas I suppose they're not approaching people saying, "Can I pray for your depression?" Because that those people's, you know, issues are not necessarily as visibly obvious as they are for you. And just take us back a little bit further, though, to where you're coming from on all this. You're not a Christian yourself. Has that ever been something that you've kind of thought about, considered before you jumped into making this documentary on disability theology?
Was that being a Christian?
Becoming
a Christian?
Did you come from any kind of church background growing up? Were you ever influenced by faith in any way?
I have family who are Pentecostal Christians.
Okay.
I have my grandmother, who was very dear to me, was a Christian, and I think would have loved nothing more than for me to become a regular churchgoer. But, you know, unfortunately, I never found myself going down that road. I lost my sight. I guess that must have been a very difficult moment for me, looking back on it. I was 13 years old. I lost my sight, was ripped away from my home life that I'd always had, and sent to a boarding school for blind kids up in Worcestershire. So about 200 miles away from where my family were. So very, very suddenly. Mm. And there was a chapel attached to this school, and every single morning we would have a chapel Christian service. And I suppose the interesting thing about that school for blind kids, about 100 of them, was that there were a very, very high proportion of Christian children there, people who came from Christian families. And you got the sense that perhaps if you have a disabled child born into your family, then one of the big things that you would reach out for in terms of looking for hope and looking for a way forward would be God.
Right.
And so I guess I was in an environment where there was a lot of Christianity, for want of a better way. But I never.
Yeah. And hence why
succumbed.
In that environment you found a number of other young people, I suppose, who had also been approached for prayer and that kind of thing, as you said.
Yes.
That was something that perhaps was part of the environment they were in and so on. Not enough time to talk about the documentary itself, which is really interesting listening. I do recommend anyone who's listening to go and check it out. It's available on BBC iPlayer, and we'll make sure there are links from today's show as well to it. But you can easily read the article version of the documentary as well over at the BBC website. And we're going to dig into some of the issues that you unpack as well in the course of today's programme. Time to introduce my other studio guest, though, and that's Zoe Hemming, who joins us. And Zoe, you're ordained in the Church of England.
I am, yeah.
How long has that been for?
I was ordained as a priest in 2015,
okay.
So not that long.
How long have you been a wheelchair user yourself, and how has that, I suppose, impacted your ministry as a priest?
I became a wheelchair user in 2010, 2011, and I'm a part-time wheelchair user because I have a nerve damage. So it's a chronic pain issue that some days is so awful I can't walk. It's all about gravity being my enemy, so I need to sit
right.
rather than stand. And one of the tools for pain management is not walking. But on a day like today, I'm on legs. It varies a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the impact on my life, it's been absolutely profound in every way.
Mm.
in terms of the practical. The practical way I just get about.
Yep.
But I had to completely reconsider everything I'd previously been taught about prayer, about a good way to live, mm-hmm. about vocation, about calling, about what I have to offer, mothering, everything really,
yep.
and particularly ministry. At that point, I wasn't expecting to go into the ministry. I, like many others, had one of those unexpected but couldn't ignore it calling experiences just at the point where I was making that transition, where I was really, really ill and absolutely loath to make a transition to using mobility aids, but being told I had no choice.
Right.
In fact, it was within a 24-hour period, I was discharged from a pain clinic, yet another department that had said, look, we've run out of options. You're going to have to live differently. And that being utterly devastating to a young mum with three children. And then having a phone call from the bishop's advisor saying, you have been recommended for full-time stipendary paid training.
Wow. Mm.
So we are going to train you for ministry. And seeing as I was already living at a training college at the time because my husband was already in training for that, they said start next weekend, basically, because I was already there. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to be able to do these things unless I sit down, because there's just no way I can get to the end of the day. You know, I was in bed half the day because I was trying to just run around after the kids and couldn't.
Mm.
So it was, everything is going to have to be different. So I had no choice but to make the transition in order to be obedient to the call that I felt God had put on my life. And that was a real wrestle with God. And I do just distinctly remember that moment of, well, how the hell's this going to work then?
Yeah.
Don't, and it actually, I was really, it makes you really vulnerable when you sit down in a wheelchair, when you suddenly become, you definitely are viewed differently, you're definitely treated differently.
Mm.
And even this many years on, the decision to come to London on wheels or on legs always is about how robust am I feeling. It's in a way that living with the pain and going on legs is easier than the social context of being seen differently, addressed differently.
Yeah.
And you're very exposed in a wheelchair. But so all of those things then were difficult to go through. And now they still are in a way, really. It's always a...
And to what extent have you experienced something along the lines of what Damon says he's experienced of sort of being a sort of approach almost out of the blue by people?
So yeah, it happens a lot. And actually, I've had lots of experiences of that, and some very negative and others less so. And that's usually to do with quite often expressed frustration of the person. If I say I'm okay, thank you. So as the vicar, I do what vicars do at the end of a service, and I'm at the door, and I've got a bar stool that is taken out there, and I sit down and speak to everybody on their way out. There was a visiting relative came with the family, and I can't remember how or why, but health came up, and I think I said, I think they might have been talking about Damon's documentary actually,
okay.
And I'd said, oh, actually, I'm healing. God has healed me in a bigger, deeper way, and I could see this visitor face suddenly look a little bit appalled.
Right.
And as they then, they started to leave, she came running back up the path, took hold of my hand, and said, "Be healed, completely healed, in Jesus' name, Amen."
And without asking permission even to pray for you.
No,
moment.
She was commanding that I understood my body differently, and that I'd misunderstood God's plan for healing. So it was really, and in that moment, it never feels good, even now, as as someone who often is talking about disability theology and know, in all sorts of different ways, as well as ministering among people of all abilities.
And I'm sure being a church priest and someone who obviously uses a wheelchair, you're even more keenly aware at this point of the kind of limitations and accessibility issues and everything else that comes with being someone who wants access to
absolutely
to
and people
worship.
Are generally delighted when I'm on legs, and that always feels somehow a little bit painful if I'm perfectly honest. I go oh, it's wonderful, the kind of things I say, it's amazing, we really do have a miraculous God. I want more than ever to sit down at that point to show as a more powerful witness to God, because we do.
I want to come back to that sense of the way in which you do feel God has worked and has healed in other sorts of ways as we get into the programme today. Time to introduce our third guest, though. It's a three-way conversation today on the show. That's Ian Paul. Ian, welcome along to the programme today. I've brought you on, Ian, joining us on the line today, because you wrote a really interesting response to the article that came out of this documentary, particularly around the whole area of disability theology and this idea that perhaps even God is disabled. You start the article in quite an interesting way, though, talking about your own limitations. And what's the point you're trying to make as you begin that article about the nature of disability itself?
Well, I find that the current dialogue we're having about disability really fascinating for the way it constructs the nature of what it means to be human and the way that we experience our humanity in different ways. I ought to begin by saying, actually, I thought Damon's article and documentary were really fantastic. And Damon, I thought you were extremely gracious towards these people, because, I was very touched by the fact that you come to the end of the online articles and having recounted your experience and say that you let the person pray for you and it seemed to do them some good, which I think was remarkable, because I think a lot of people in your situation would have actually been really angry and told the person exactly where to go. And I thought that itself was really helpful. And that your gracious engagement with that, I think, is the thing that enables the conversation. But the thing I was struck as I was reflecting about it is the fact that I am disabled. I don't look disabled. I'm not obviously disabled to most people, although from time to time it becomes more evident. I have in the past just been an occasional wheelchair user. I had a really serious bout of sciatica about 12 years ago. And in fact, I was going to a conference in the States and I was stuck in the airport because I just could not walk through the airport. And in fact, one of my fellow conference attendees rescued me by finding a wheelchair and whizzing me through the terminal in that. So that itself was an interesting experience. But I think my reflection on the fact that I have I've got eight different disabilities of varying degrees of severity. And that made me realize that actually being disabled, I know in contemporary discussion, being disabled is a category or a label, and very often people either identify as disabled or not disabled. Actually, my reflection was we all have different degrees of disability, and those degrees of disability belong to our finitude as creatures. We are finite, we are limited. when I'm looking, obviously disabled, when I'm having trouble walking or standing, I, because of back trouble exacerbated by a leg injury, I sometimes find it difficult to continue to stand or to walk. I need to sit down and stretch my back out. And when people see that I have a problem and they come and pray for me, if they want to pray for me, that's great, because they may have very mixed motives. They may, and I think Damon's quite right in saying that, you know, sadly, a lot of Christians do have motives about their own ability and concerns, as we said, about their own power in prayer, and it undermines that possibly slightly fragile confidence in God if they see that there is something that God hasn't answered our prayer. But if people offer to pray for me, I say, well, that's great. Whatever motive you've got, I am a limited person. I am finite. I am a creature. I cannot do what God has called me to do on my own. So if anyone wants to pray for me, I'm up for that. Obviously, there are some bigger issues around manipulation and power, but I would welcome that. And the other thing I find is really striking is that the kind of motivations that some Christians have in wanting to fix things and make things better, in using people as disabled people as a vehicle, as it were, for their own theological exercise. What I'm really struck about is that that's exactly the opposite of what we find Jesus doing in the New Testament. And I think when Candida Ross Moss says that Jesus is going around using physical people as a way of fixing the world and demonstrating his power, I think that's a really serious misreading, actually, of the New Testament. And there are lots of examples where we can see very clearly Jesus is doing exactly the opposite.
We'll come back to that, because I want to talk about the way what Candida Moss said in the documentary and in the article as well, Damon. But firstly, before I just leave you and talk to Damon again, Ian, are you generally speaking sort of okay with people praying for healing? Do you believe that God heals, you know, disabilities, illness, sickness today? Not for everyone, obviously, but that it does happen, if you like.
Yeah, yes, I do. And for example, I've got a friend who's in our church who's also actually training for ministry, and she had a very specific disability arising from an accident when she was quite young, and I mean she was one of those, you know, classic Pentecostal cases of actual leg lengthening, and someone actually videoed it, and so yes, she did experience physical healing from a disability. But what is really fascinating, I think this connects with some of the things that Zoe was saying about, you know, what is the real issue here, is that she will always say, yes, I did experience healing of my body, but you know what? The bigger miracle, the more important thing in the longer term, was actually God ministering to my own sense of self-esteem and my anger and my disappointment. And in fact, the bigger miracle is what God did on the inside, not what God did on the outside. But we live in a world where we do not see things perfected. We are still awaiting. We have a foretaste of the kingdom, the power of God in healing, but we do not see it all. And I find it puzzling when people are disappointed, like the person who prayed for Zoe and you know, commanding healing, and the person is disappointed that God hasn't yet answered that prayer. Well, I hope she's equally disappointed that God hasn't answered the prayer to stop famine in the world, or to stop wars, or to stop ecological disaster. There are lots of things we pray for, and we do not yet see the answers. And if we pray for physical healing and we do not yet see the answers for that, I don't think anyone should be surprised about that. We're told that's going to be the case, and we need to be patient as well as persistent.
Damon, let's come to you. What isn't reflected in the article, but was really interesting to hear in the radio documentary, was you actually begin by going out with a team of people, the Healing on the Streets team, who, you know, go up to the general public kind of in the way that you've been approached before, asking people if there's anything they can pray for and so on. And you even attended a healing meeting as well. And this was of the more sort of charismatic variety, if you like. What was your takeaway from that? What's your view of whether there is anything in the idea that God actually does heal people who do want to be healed and that kind of thing?
People who want to be healed. I think, I mean, one of the things I witnessed, and I think we talked about in the documentary, was that obviously the people who went along to the service were sort of self-selecting, I suppose, to put it.
They wanted to be there.
In a very unpleasant reductive way. They wanted to be there. They wanted to be healed. They wanted to feel God's presence. And so they had their day made, I think. And certainly the people in the street, one of the people we came across was clearly absolutely delighted that she was given a lot of attention by the healer, Jonathan, on the street. And it, you know, it was nice to see. She obviously had her... I was talking to Zoe about this earlier. She obviously had her endorphins rushing and something happened inside her that made her feel
this,
really,
this
really good.
This was someone who was using a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And I listened to the documentary and she did say, well, it does feel like my pain has gone at that moment. Obviously, you weren't there to see how she was 24 hours later or anything, but at least in that moment, something appeared to have happened. But I'm guessing you would put it down to more... as you say, endorphins or some sort of adrenaline rush.
I don't know. I hope I'm not sort of diminishing what happened there by saying that. But certainly, she had attention from someone who was taking her very seriously, and who wanted her to feel good, and she enjoyed that very much.
Yeah. But would your general view be, I suppose, and I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but that from your point of view, if anything does happen in a healing meeting or someone being approached on the streets, it's more a psychological thing than God kind of stepping in and doing something in that situation. And you won't be offending anyone by saying that, if that is your view, by the way. So don't feel you have to kind of, you know, pull any sort of, you know.
Well, I guess we are... Sorry, if you hear my dog in the
That's
background,
fine, yeah.
It's DB the dog on the floor, and very, whining.
Very, and very beautiful. Is it she?
My guide dog is a boy.
Right, yeah. Well, he is a beautiful, beautiful guide dog. I should have introduced as a chili part of the lineup of the show.
Singing voice.
Right on key. I guess there are lots of impairments, I would call them, that are, I mean, you can say that you feel better if you... there's certain things that are more easy to sort of fix in the moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you have some pain, I mean, I've been in pain before. I broke my ribs a few months ago. And I know that when I'm distracted, I...
don't think about it.
Don't think about it.
Yeah.
And I know that if something really good and positive comes my way, I feel so much better, and probably for a while, a bit like Doctor Theatre, which is what actors talk about, they can feel really good. Mm. What we didn't see, I guess, was people being cured from cerebral palsy and or blindness or profound deafness or those really big sort of category things that we think of in disability when we think of disabled people.
We're going to take a quick pause, go to our first break, and we'll be back continuing to talk today about disability healing, the theology around that. Is it time for Christians to stop trying to heal people on the streets and that sort of thing? That was sort of part of the issue for Damon Rose, who's one of my guests today, BBC presenter and producer.
Makes me feel bad when you put it like
no,
that.
No, but you know, I think it was a very grabbing title, and I think it's a question that needs to be asked.
Yeah.
Also joined today by Reverend Zoe Hemming and Ian Paul, who have both been in that documentary and responded to it as well, as we continue to discuss this topic. I'd be interested in hearing what you think as well. Do feel free to email the show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or get in touch via our social media. Twitter is @unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. All of those links available from the show page, and to listen back there as well at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
In a world where fake news is taken at face value and fiction has become fact, how do we share true faith in Jesus? Unbelievable the Conference 2019 will equip a new generation to speak truth in a post-truth world. Join me, Justin Briley, and a team of world-class speakers ready to give reasons for Christian hope in today's sceptical world. Unbelievable the Conference 2019, Saturday the 20th of July in London. Brought to you in partnership with ADF International and Biola Apologetics. Book now at premierchristianradio.com/speakingtruth.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking about disability and healing today on the programme. Damon Rose put together a radio documentary and article. The article was called Stop Trying to Heal Me, and raised the whole question of whether Christians should be offering prayer for healing with those with for those with disabilities. And Damon himself, not a Christian, and I think has provoked really interesting conversations among Christians about this whole issue. Certainly there were lots of conversations on my social media when people in my timeline were sharing it. Reverend Zoe Hemming featured in the documentary and article as an ordained priest and occasional wheelchair user. She believes Christians do need to rethink their approach to disability theology. And Reverend Ian Paul, a theologian, also responded to the article as well on his own blog, and we'll be hearing more from him in a moment's time. Zoe, you've already said that your approach to healing has changed, the way you think about it, quite a lot with your own experience, obviously. I mean, in what ways has that changed? And do you still believe that God does, if you like, heal in very obviously tangible physical ways, people, you know, leaving their wheelchair and walking and being healed and so on? And I'd love to hear about your own experience of what you felt was a deeper sense of healing as well in your own life.
Sure. I probably start all of this by saying that 100% my faith that God can and does do unexpected things hasn't changed.
Okay.
What has changed, though, is my hesitance to say that cure is not the norm. When we pray for people to get better physically, whatever that is ailing them, that usually doesn't happen. And the reason I'm really passionate about saying that a bit more is because I think there's been a culture of what felt like to me the emperor's new clothes. And I think actually Christians lose a kind of legitimate voice in a perfectly reasonable question to ask. And I think Damon articulates it well, and perhaps shouldn't be so worried about upsetting people, because you don't do that with that question. Because I think Christians need to be having these conversations too. Because, you know, when I first came to faith, we were part of a very big, charismatic, evangelical free church. And at that stage, I had 4 days a week of migraines. It was very disabling. And I was prayed for on numerous occasions. I was anointed with oil. You read that passage from James. And, you know, when you're ill, that's what you do. And by his stripes, you are healed, etc., etc. And there was a great deal of passion and fervour about that. And I was repeatedly prayed for and never experienced any kind of healing. And as a new Christian, that left me really vulnerable, because there was a sense of frustration from those who were praying for me. And it was really difficult to... And there was definitely... if you have enough faith, then you will be. And I really think we need to be talking about that stuff, the kind of name it, claim it theology, because I think it's dangerous and it turns God into a dispenser rather than something far more holistic, far more radical, actually. Because extend the argument about healing and don't think about, you know, particular categories of people. And actually, Ian, I totally agree with you and think it's important to talk about, you know, that this peculiar badge that we have, and that to be human is to be limited. And that's another thing that I think we need to talk about a lot more. And there are those visible disabilities which kind of make you stick out and the focus for these conversations. But the kind of... You know, at what point do you stop praying for someone's physical healing? When they're 75? Or
right, exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
And you know, I am very short-sighted, but I wear contact lenses, and that absolutely fixes the problem, and it's hardly inconvenient at all in the way that that sort of a disability, if I lived in an age before glasses and contact lenses, it would be a massive issue, because I'd be almost, you know. But I've never felt the need to ask anyone to pray for me to be healed from that particular thing, because technology today has allowed it to be almost superfluous in my own life, that what would otherwise be a major issue. So it's kind of like there's lots of different ways of approaching it.
Yeah, there is. And I do think that it brings into lots of unhealthy social narratives about youth, for example. So, you know, elderly people in wheelchairs, I bet, don't get prayed for very often.
Right.
Because it's a sense of, well, no, we're all right with you dying, or we're all right with you not being fully able. So there's this really weird ableist kind of expectation.
What I mean, you were featured in the documentary actually holding a healing service, though. So
yeah,
what does that look like now in your church, Zoe?
In our church, it looks like being really deliberate about saying, yeah, we're all limited, and what a blessed relief it is that there's a power beyond me to shape my life. And that sense of surrender to God, that surrender to something beyond ourselves, a surrender of our own expectations about what we shouldn't be. And that is, I think, an incredibly powerful thing. And it's also amazingly good news.
Mm.
Because, you know, when we do that, when we say, no, it's not about my power, it's not about what I can do, there's something which then helps you to love your neighbour quite a lot more easily as well.
and just to round that off, you do describe again in the documentary a point at which you did feel that a sense of healing came.
Yeah.
But it wasn't obviously to be physical healing.
No, in this instance. And it was completely unexpected. And I was in agony that day and really, really wanted healing. But I had stopped being... You know, for a couple of years, I'd stopped allowing myself to be in situations where someone was going to try and pray for my healing, because I just felt lower and more disappointed each time it didn't happen. And it really was harmful to my faith journey, because it wasn't talked about when it doesn't work. And that's something we definitely need to do better.
Yeah. Own up to it, yeah.
Yeah, and I think church leaders need to be talking about what do we say when someone doesn't get cured and does die.
We need a theology of... Yeah, of when it doesn't
theology
happen.
Theology of illness and theology of frailty and theology of disappointment. And because otherwise well, the theology of hope gets completely lost.
What did give you hope in the end, though?
It was weird. I received it felt like a very physiological, supernatural sense. I was sitting there in pain being prayed for, and I felt my head being physically lifted, which was a very odd feeling, because I was embarrassed. I thought I was being a nuisance, and actually, as someone who uses a wheelchair, I often still do. But my head lifted, my back straightened. I mean, I don't have a problem with my back, so that wasn't an issue. And I looked at the cross, and I found myself speaking out, and it was not something I would have been comfortable doing. I really was very intimidated by all these trainee vicars.
Mm.
And I said, thank you for lifting my head. Please don't let me bow it again. And it's a weird thing. I actually can't pray with my head down. No. And this really doesn't fit with my kind of church practice, which is fairly middle of the road mainstream these days. Mm. But that sense of just be who you are now in this moment. I'm with you. It's all right to just be you, and that sense of surrender. And well, I think I describe it as a new dignity, because that's how I experienced it. I stopped feeling, oh, this isn't all right, there's something not okay about me. And I didn't like my pain, and I don't like my pain, but that bigger sense of you are not alone.
We'll come back to this, because and Ian, I'd be interested in hearing your reflections on it too. But before we do that, Damon, one of the big aspects of the documentary and article was sort of exploring what you describe there as a group of academics who are carving out a new theology of disability, a relatively new academic field. And one of those that you interview is Candida Moss. Tell us sort of what you were finding out about how people are rethinking disability and how it particularly applies to things like, you know, whether we're even take disability with us beyond this life, and even this idea, which may seem strange at first sight, that God is disabled in some way. What were the things you were hearing in the course of this documentary?
Well, Candida was saying things like the idea that disabled people were often used as kind of ciphers or ways to show that Jesus was powerful.
Shall I quote from the article here? Because one of the things she says is that when Jesus meets people with disabilities, he fixes them, and that's a sign that he is powerful. That relegates people with disabilities to just being there to show the power of God. They're not really real characters or real people who have feelings and needs and personalities. That pushes them to the margins of the story. So, and that's one of the things that I'll get Ian to respond to. But you got that sense that Candida felt the Gospels weren't really necessarily always helpful in the way it portrays disabled people in that way.
Very strong words, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what she goes on to talk about is the other things that you could potentially take from the Bible, and you're going to have to help me out here with which bit of
you're not coming as a theologian. I think
this comes
fine.
From, but the oft quoted image of God in a throne with wheels, which to what a lot of disabled people who are sort of espousing the disability theology are saying is a nice, pleasant symbol of the power and worth of disabled people that's in the Bible.
And those images come from places like, I think, Ezekiel, for instance, says that vision of Ezekiel of wheels within wheels. And it's all, to some extent, quite mysterious. But obviously some people like Candida and other disability theologians would say that's a really interesting way of thinking of God's throne having wheels. There's a sense in which the most important seat in the whole Bible is actually a wheelchair, which is an interesting. I mean, what do you think of that idea, Zoe? Do you think that sort of sense?
It's an interesting idea. I don't read the Bible in that way and would look at literally at that, but I do like it as an image of a God. Well, I like many diverse images of God, and actually when we try to make God fit what our theology is, which we all do and the church always has done, I think drawing on ones that images of God that we've never had before are great, because there's loads in there.
One of the most inspiring and I thought moving interviews in the documentary was with Becky Tyler, who 16-year-old, and I think she's a quadriplegic, cerebral palsy, and she was actually interestingly preached at the Greenbelt Festival a couple of years ago, and I saw that obviously covered widely in religious media and national as well, and communicates effectively through a sort of a voice program by using sight and so on. What was your experience of her as someone who's obviously a very committed Christian, Damon, who obviously has not experienced physical healing in that way, but obviously has this very, it felt like to me at least listening to her, strong trust and faith in God. What did you take away from that particular encounter?
Well, she was getting empowerment and worth and self-belief from those kind of images. Dog again, sorry.
Don't worry. It's no problem at all.
which was a great interpretation, far more, I would say, as a non-Christian, it feels more empowering than people, lining up to seek healing from Jesus on the streets because their lives are not good lives. And of course, there's a big historical issue there. We should talk about how things were very different back in the day, 2,000 years ago, when Jesus was around. Disabled people were, of course, very much more cast out and cast to the margins. These days, society has put a technology and all sorts of things in place, laws, education, in order to give embedded, proper empowerment to disabled people. But Becky really did seek strength from that image, for instance, of God in his wheelchair. And I guess, who's to say that image, that particular thing taken from the Bible is more canon or more important? I'm probably using the wrong word.
Don't, it's fine. Well, you're not here as a theologian, and don't feel bad about whether you're using the right language.
Who's to suggest that image and that interpretation is the right one or the wrong one?
Well, Ian, I'd be interested in your reflections on this, because this is where a large part of your response blog focused on some of these issues around the way Jesus was described by Candida Moss as a sort of, beefed up miracle worker, and the sort of people he met were sort of basically there just to show off his supernatural powers. And also this interesting idea of is God disabled at some level in the Bible? So tell us what you kind of responded to on that level in your article.
Well, I think my first response in terms of how Candida talks about the Gospels is, I think it's just actually a really poor reading of the Gospels, and it's not actually what we find there. And the idea that Jesus uses quote unquote disabled people as a prop, I think the language he uses, as a prop to demonstrate his power, is a really poor misreading. And for those who are doing healing on the streets, or for the people Damon experienced, I would say to them, actually, the issue here is you're not paying enough attention to what Jesus actually does. One classic example is in John chapter 9, quite a well-known story of Jesus healing a man born blind. And in fact, it's the disciples who want to use him as a prop. They use him as a prop for a theological discussion. Rabbi, they say, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They're the ones who are wanting to manipulate and to use him as an object. And in fact, what happens is that Jesus simply dismisses their concerns and says, do you know what? Actually, you're completely wrong. And the narrative, apart from being marginalized, this man becomes absolute center stage. The narrative revolves around who he is, his courage, his repudiation of the both the disciples and the Pharisees, who both want to use him as an exercise in their theological discussion. And actually what we find is Jesus takes him aside, and Jesus is the one who treats him with dignity. And other examples in the Gospels as well, a couple of chapters earlier in John chapter 5, there's been a man who's been sitting for years by a pool wanting healing, and Jesus says to him, what do you want me to do for you? So far from, manipulating this person with his power, Jesus actually gives power to the person he's dealing with. Very well-known story in Sunday schools, kids are always making little models of this, is the paralytic who's lowered through the roof by his friends. And again, it connects very much with what Zoe was saying. You'd think that Jesus seeing a paralytic and his friends are clearly expecting Jesus to do something for him, you kind of think the first thing Jesus would do would be to heal his paralysis. But Jesus doesn't. Jesus says, you know what? There's actually a more important thing here at stake, which is that you need to know forgiveness of your sins. And that's what he deals with first. And then only subsequently does physical healing come. So I think Candler's reading is actually quite a poor misreading. And actually, we could all learn much from the compassion of Jesus. He humanizes people. He restores them, not only physically, but one of the things that disability does, or visible disability, is it particularly in first century culture, where people were often fearful of those who are disabled or unwell or have mental health problems, because those people disrupted their view of the world. And so they often, people with recognizable disabilities often lived separately with diseases. They were shunned. Jesus heals the what's called a Gerasene demoniac. I think we'd probably now say he had some really serious mental health issues. Jesus not only heals him, but he then restores him to community. So he actually rebuilds relationship. And frequently Jesus says to those he's healed who want to follow him and form this new community, he says, actually what you need to do is you need to go back and be restored to the community which has previously marginalized you. So I think we need to learn from the Gospels and not say the Gospels are part of the problem.
And in that sense, I guess it could be said that whether it be physical healing today, or indeed simply making it possible for disabled people to engage with dignity in society, in church and everywhere else, it's doing the same job of restoring people's dignity and wholeness and sense of community, regardless of whether or not that may involve a physical healing in.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I thought it was really fascinating when Damon said some things are easier to fix in the moment. And it is interesting that we unconsciously adopt a view that, as it were, physical impairments are the real impairments, and psychological, emotional, mental things are actually relatively easily fixable. So we talk about, psychosomatic healing and all that kind of thing. Well, if that's the case, how come so many of us in culture today live with chronic loneliness? We carry with us the psychological burdens from things we've experienced in the past, particularly from our early childhood and upbringing. Actually, these things are not easily fixable. I think it's fascinating that woman who was being prayed for, who has this sense of empowerment and self-worth, because, the people praying for her are giving her attention and are making her feel important. Well, it's really interesting to ask, what does it take to change people, to change us from being those who treat others instrumentally, who pass by, who ignore, who diminish others? What does it take to change that attitude?
Can I just jump in and say that I really wasn't saying that people with depression or mental health problems are easily fixable in a moment. That isn't what I'm saying.
What did you mean by what you said? Just that there are some things that people can experience in the moment, which like a feeling of pain leaving them for a time.
I very strongly believe in parity of care in terms of physical and mental health. I think they're interconnected and they are just as important as each other.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No getting away from that. What I was talking about there was in terms of examples. How can you prove or suggest a miracle has happened?
In a given moment,
and it is something to do with the difference between visible and invisible.
Yeah. Sorry, did you want to finish your thought? And I'll
I'd agree with that. But for instance, when I came to faith, then it had a radical impact on my own sense of self-esteem, and that was highly significant and happened kind of in a moment.
And I'm
not suggesting that, you know, we should differentiate between mental and physical issues. I agree with Damon, but if an encounter with God transforms people's a sense of self-esteem and self-worth, then that isn't trivial. That is important. Yeah. And I agree that, you know, we don't often see miraculous physical healing, although we do. I have from time to time.
That'd be interesting to hear your perspective on that as well, Zoe. The kind of how Jesus plays into this.
Yeah,
as
well, and I would add that the physical, physical, mental, and social healing. And I really, you know, I love the fact that you can have read a story a dozen times and then, you know, 5 years later you see something that's suddenly like, oh, flipping heck. Mm. So that the story about the man that you referred to, Ian, around the healing pool and Jesus saying, what do you want me to do for me? That story includes the fact that he'd been there a really long time. Every time the springs started to bubble, he couldn't get in because everybody else rushed in. Mm. So there's a man who's just really very marginalised practically and in every other way. So to be seen, perhaps in a parallel with that woman who was prayed for on the streets by Jonathan, that what do you want me to do for you? That sense of crossing a boundary and saying, I see you. Mm. And then offering practical support, which actually is what he, you know, could you lift me in the waters next time? Could you make sure there's room for me? Is what his response could have been. So that stuff, you know, and Jesus didn't just do that with disabled people, because he also was in no way systematic with his healing. If physical healing was so core to his objective, as many people who believe and lead healing prayer ministries say, and Jonathan does say in the documentary, so core to the gospel, then Jesus would have been far more systematic about that. But every healing story that we have tells a much bigger social story, that who is included and who isn't. And just as today, there's hard lines being drawn around church. You're either in or you're out. You have to be this or you have to be that. Jesus is telling that story and walking among people. So the woman at the well that he goes and talks to, you know, she was there in the middle of the day because she was such a social outcast. And he went and talked to her. And there was lots of reasons why it was shocking and radical. Mm. And so, you know, you could take from that story stuff about, well, Jesus supernaturally knew about her sexual history. Far more powerful is the fact that Jesus crossed boundaries that other people wouldn't in order to show that God is and God's love is for everyone.
And how is the church doing in reflecting that, in your opinion, Zoe? To what extent do we see the range of disability that's present in the general population, if you like, reflected in church? Or is church a difficult place to be someone who
it's a really difficult place, and I think the church needs to be doing a lot better, which is why I am in my leadership in church talking about when prayer doesn't feel like it's worked.
Right.
Because what you have is you know, you have that kind of people that you roll in order to... The church can easily do exactly the same in terms of what Jesus is being accused of doing, which I think I agree with Paul. I don't agree with her on that Jesus isn't using disabled people as a prop, although it's a legitimate reading of it. I think if potentially we do the same in church, and there are so many people in the church who are isolated and who don't feel able to express their disappointment, their frustration, their lack of feeling any kind of encounter with God. If we only ever sing songs that say that God is healing and comforting, but we don't articulate as actually, and sometimes not, then we risk and it's very much well-being, mental health, physical health, spiritual health, and social health, which I think are impacted, and we make people more isolated than they should be.
I mean, Damon, beyond this documentary, I don't know how often you darken the door of a church, but when you have on occasion, what's been your sense of whether that has been an accessible, inclusive kind of experience when it comes to churches?
Do you know what the big thing that comes out when I think about that is obviously it's going to be church, it's going to be weddings, it's going to be funerals. I attended a rather nice Christmas carol event with the Archbishop of Canterbury as well.
There you go.
You know,
get you name drop
at Christmas. A lot of the time, most of the time when I go to church, when everybody else stands up to sing, I stand up. And I've got no accessible hymn book.
Right.
So I don't know the words, and I just stand there. Sometimes I think, oh, shall I open my mouth and pretend I'm singing along?
Have you seen the Mr. Bean sketch where he doesn't know the words to the song and it basically just sings the chorus really loudly, which he does know? It's a
yeah,
classic
that's,
one.
That's what I do.
I love it.
But anyway, so okay, there's very obvious ways then in which churches, there are things that your disability means that you can't engage in the service in the way that everyone else does in that way. I mean,
oh, can I just say as well, standing up and sitting down,
right? Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
It can
not
be
knowing when to do it,
yeah,
not knowing if everyone,
when everyone else
has or
sat
hasn't.
Down and I'm left standing up.
Oh no.
Oh dear. Oh, you don't want that to happen.
That's the thing. I mean, what would help in that situation? Would just clearer directions from the person leading the service help? Is it just that it's helpful if people just take the initiative around you to say, we're sitting down now, or whatever it might be?
It'd be nice if the person at the front would say, you know, all stand, all sit, just something like that.
But I find it really difficult when people say things like, let's stand to declare our faith. People who can't stand are in... I've never felt more lonely than in church when everybody does.
I was recently at a big Christian event, and good on them, they give some training ahead of time of when you're engaging with people who have disabilities, what's helpful and what's not. And one of the things they're very clear on for speakers is, if you're inviting people to stand, please make clear, it's stand if you're able to do so. This isn't a command for everyone.
If you are comfortably able is the phrase.
Right.
That we are that I've found myself using, because there is such a culture of peer pressure and not wanting to get things wrong. And it, you know, even Damon, who you know would be a visitor in your mind, I guess, feeling that real peer pressure and stigma. And actually, it took years before I would allow myself to sit down in church, because I thought it was showing a lack of love for God.
Right.
Somehow we've connected loving God with being willing to suffer, and that's terrible and really sad. So stand if you're comfortably able.
We're going to go to our final break, and we'll just have 10 minutes of further reflection from my three guests today. We're talking about disability, healing and theology on the show today. Fascinating engagement between my guests Damon Rose, Zoe Hemming and Ian Paul. Be back in a moment's time.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the programme. Also available as a video over at the video channel on YouTube, or you can watch it from the show page. Today's show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links, of course, to my guests there as well. Before we go back to the final part of their discussion, just want to let you know that Ed Atkinson and the group who organised the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptics meetup group in London are going to be meeting this Monday, the 1st of July, 7:30 as usual, at their new venue, the Cock Tavern, near King's Cross. This time, Andrew White doing his thing. He was on the show a few weeks ago, you may remember. He's calling it A Failure to Communicate, Reflections on Christian Diversity. That'll be followed, as usual, by a marvellous discussion among the people who turn up. So if you want to get along to that, just go to the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group on meetup.com to find out more details. And I'm looking forward to probably seeing some members of that group turning up for this year's Unbelievable Conference as well, Saturday the 20th of July. I'll be speaking shortly to Craig Hazen towards the end of today's programme. He's coming to the conference along with a team from Biola Apologetics to lead an apologetics masterclass, some really great topics that they'll be uncovering. I'll be talking to Craig shortly. The way to make sure that you're there there. To hear what Craig and the team have to say is by going to the website and booking yourself in at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference. If you can stick around after today's show here on Premier Christian Radio, I'm going to be sitting down with Pete Portal on the profile. Pete is an extraordinary person. He and his wife lead a kind of community house in one of the roughest ghettos in South Africa, Manenberg. And he's written an extraordinary book called No Neutral Ground about that ministry, about how he came to faith himself, and just what they see as they minister to Muslim gang members, drug addicts, and just an extraordinary life that they lead out there witnessing to Christ. So you'll hear all about it on the profile this afternoon between 4 and 5, or indeed get it on podcast. Here on Unbelievable next week, we've got a youth special. We'll be hearing what questions young people are asking, as I'm joined by an old friend of the show, David Robertson. Just before he actually heads out to Australia, actually, we were able to sit down and record an edition of the show. And he's going to be in conversation with a young atheist, Hannah Timpson. She was on the show just over a year ago, as they look, as a Christian and an atheist, at some of these questions asked by young people. David has a new book out in which he addresses questions that have come in from all over the world from young people. And I sat down with some young people I know to get them to ask their tough questions about faith as well. You'll hear how David and Hannah respond on next week's edition of the show. It also struck me this past couple of weeks that my book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, has been available for 2 years now. I think it was June 2017 that it came out. I'll be signing copies again at the conference, of course, for anyone who would like any. But it was lovely to also receive some encouragement from an atheist who got in touch on Twitter. Tara said, thoroughly enjoying Unbelievable's book, Unbelievable, at the moment. As an atheist, it's thrown me many times, but really made me think about what makes a Christian apologetics book good, namely talking to atheists and good arguments. And then Tara followed that up with another tweet to say, finished in the early hours of this morning, thought-provoking, moving and easy to read. Threw me many times, as does the podcast, but all in all very enjoyable, restoring respect for apologetics in a respectful way that encourages dialogue. All I can say is well done. Was absolutely thrilled to receive that commendation from you, Tara. Thank you very much. So glad as well that you were able to review the book as well and give some helpful pointers as to what you think helps and doesn't help when it comes to Christians who write books that are aimed at non-Christians. So that was nice to receive. We'll get some more of your feedback as well towards the end of today's show. For now, let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of today's show. We've been talking about disability, healing, theology, all in light of a really interesting BBC documentary by Damon Rose, one of my guests today, who's blind, titled Pick Up Your Stretcher and Walk, and an accompanying article, Stop Trying to Heal Me, which raised the whole question of whether Christians should be offering prayer for healing with those with disabilities. Reverend Zoe Hemming, who's featured in the documentary and article, also joins us. She's a priest and a wheelchair user. And Reverend Ian Paul, also a theologian who wrote a response blog to the article, has been on the line with us as well today. We've been talking, Ian, about ways in which disability theologians have started to think about this issue a bit. One of those issues was that sort of whole idea of in Ezekiel's vision of God and the wheels within wheels, you know, is that God in a wheelchair effectively? And that for some is a very helpful way of thinking about God, that God is disabled at some level and kind of restores a certain aspect of dignity that actually God understands and is familiar with that sense. Mm. What's your take on that before we talk about some other issues?
Well, I think she uses two images she picks up. One is this so-called heavenly wheelchair. And the other is the claim that Jesus being wounded takes his disability, as it were, into the heavenly places. Unfortunately, I think both of those are quite mistaken readings. It does raise the question of how we use the Bible and whether we can pull out of the Bible and shape for ourselves in a sort of plastic way these images. Unfortunately, I don't think it works, because in our culture, the reason why having a wheelchair is something of a stigma is it shows that you're unable to do things. In Ezekiel, the whole point about the wheels on the throne is it shows that God is able to do things and is able to do even more than Ezekiel had expected. Ezekiel was thinking that God's throne, as it were, was in a fixed place in Jerusalem. That temple, that place has been destroyed. And the vision he has is saying, no, God's power and sovereignty actually is over all places. It's not simply restricted to one place. And of course, Jesus is, yes, he takes his wounds into heaven, but that doesn't disable him. The primary image in the New Testament is that Jesus is now ascended at the right hand of the Father. He's sovereign. Jesus is Lord, is the great early acclamation. And I think the reason why we're led into these mistaken use of these images is we're starting from a mistaken premise. And it comes back to the very beginning of the program. And the mistaken premise is that there are two categories of humanity, the able-bodied and the disabled. And my personal experience, and I think my reflection on the discourse we find in a society, and my reflection on Scripture, is that Scripture just does not see humanity in those two categories. And the issue we have, and I can understand the practical reasons for that, which is that people do experience marginalization, they experience people neglecting them, or, you know, someone in a wheelchair, people will talk to the wheelchair pusher, not the person in the wheelchair. There's a serious need to address that. But the way often that happens is that people say, oh, there's a category called disabled, and then we now, and this category is excluded, and we now need to include them. And I would say theologically, that category doesn't exist in the sense that we all belong to a limited humanity. And for the extent to which I'm disabled, I see that as part of my finitude. And I think that's really important. Interestingly, Candid Amos seems to be making that assumption, saying that they're able-bodied and disabled. That assumption is shared with those that Damon experienced wanting to pray for him, because as far as they were concerned, they were whole and complete and able-bodied. He wasn't. He had something that needed fixing him, and therefore they needed to pray for him so that he could become like them. But actually, that's ignoring the fact that they themselves, all those praying, have different disabilities and they have their own limitations. There are not these two categories.
Damon, you wanted to say something?
I just put my hand up. I forgot there were cameras in there.
That's fine.
Quite a little radio session. I suspect Candida wasn't talking about impairments in a term, and thinking along those lines of, a spectrum of kind of wellness or ability. Usually when we talk about disabled people and non-disabled people, we're thinking about people who consider themselves disabled or who don't consider themselves disabled. And these are sort of societal constructs, aren't they? There's this whole medical model of disability and the social model of disability, whereby the medical model is where essentially we're saying, well, there's something wrong with you, you're blind, you're going to have to not read the hymn book. I mean, you are blind. Whereas the social model of disability would say, oh, goodness me, actually, it's our responsibility to make sure that you're included in this great society of ours, and that we provide you with a hymn book that you can read. Voila, you know, problem solved. Everybody's happy. So I suspect that that's what she was thinking about, Ian.
I'd agree, Damon, but I think, again, theologically, I would say, well, we all have limitations. So here's the question. Just take the example of being able to read the words of a hymn book. Okay, why should we make the hymn book 12-point in size rather than 4-point in size? You know, a lot of people are going to struggle to read 4-point. Most people can read 12-point text. Some people can't read printed text at all. So actually, any decision about making things available, it involves an arbitrary decision about who's going to be included and who not. And actually, theologically, if we see all of humanity on that spectrum, all belonging together, our decisions need to reflect the fact that everybody wants to be involved. So, for example, we've got a number of visually impaired people in our church. I like to use visual images on the screen when I'm preaching. But in order to include everybody, I need to describe what is on the screen so that those who can't see clearly actually understand it. And that's not just people who are blind. That's also people who are getting on a bit, or they're a bit short-sighted, or the sun's shining in and the projector isn't working all that well, you know. And actually, the issue for me is saying, how do we include all? Not because there are these two categories. And I would agree with you. I theologically want to deconstruct this sense of we are able-bodied and we are disabled. And the way we do that is all recognizing that we are finite humanity. We all have our limitations. And the question is, whose limitations are you going to accommodate? We are always accommodating limitations of one kind or another.
Zoe.
My argument would be against drawing an arbitrary line on that.
I'm not sure there is. I think that's pretty consistent in Christian theology, that actually we have different limitations, and that weird arbitrary line, I agree, is a strange one, an us and them, and that does nobody, including the church, any good whatsoever. And I think actually the way you're expressing it is can really help shift the perspective of, oh, let's do something nice for that group of people there. So when I go around, you know, my as well as a vicar, I'm the disability advisor for Lichfield, and I go around saying, everybody can read, I use the example you did, actually, everybody can read it if it's bigger. None of our arms are getting any shorter, let's be honest. Mm. And so if we build church and articulate our theology in a way that is about everybody, then I think it goes so much better, so much further in articulating the good news.
Just with the short amount of time we've got left, that there was just an interesting aspect of the program and the article, which was the idea of whether we even take disability with us into the kingdom come, heaven, the new creation, whatever what phrase you want to use for it. And that was where, you know, that idea that Jesus in his resurrected form still had the nail scars in his hands and so on. Now, Ian's point is he doesn't think that necessarily gives the sense that Jesus is disabled, but rather perhaps it's that everything that it's the wounds of love, if you like, that that Jesus takes with him into eternity. What's your view on that? You know, will everyone be healed of every physical disability in the kingdom to come, Zoe, in your view? Or is it bigger than that? I don't know.
I agree with Paul in that, you know, this whole we're all limited thing. But the idea that Jesus's wounds are limited only to tell that story, because, you know, I think the story that they tell is bigger than that. I think they tell a story of a God who experiences what we do and remains whole, and that we that him going ascending to heaven with a body that would still have been very broken. And if we say, okay, yeah, well, he'll have had holes in his hands and feet and a hole in his side, actually, from that, because he still got hungry and you know, other physiological needs, presumably he'll have had some nerve pain. And so why not? You know, why does it matter that Jesus, why do we have to say that Jesus isn't the same as us? But I do think when we go to heaven, our stories are what make us us. And so the idea of separating us from our own story, albeit a restored story, a story where we are as God intends us, but our lived experience is also where we find God. Yeah. So I don't think it's helpful to try and assume that all of that will just be washed away, because I think that won't be us.
Quick response, Ian, and then I'll give Damon the final word as we close out the show.
Well, it was very interesting in discussing this online on social media, and I had quite a number of folk who were both had disabilities themselves or had family members with disabilities saying, well, I really hope they are, because we'd really like to be, you know, put out of our discomfort and pain. Mm-hmm. One person put it, I thought, rather poetically, saying, well, what I imagine is that I will see the scars of what I've experienced, but actually I will no longer suffer from the inhibition. And I think one of the issues is that, you know, our limitations and our disabilities often produce something in us which we wouldn't otherwise have, a sense of patience or a sense of awareness, or we're made aware of others and their needs, and so we have compassion blindness. So these things have produced fruit in our lives, and certainly we wouldn't want to lose that. Maybe that's another way of using Zoe's language, saying that we take the story of what God has done in us and with us and through us because of our limitations and our disabilities. We'll take those stories with us.
I did say final word to you, Damon. So what's been your experience overall of going through doing the documentary, the article, and of course all the reaction you've had from Christians and non-Christians towards it? Do you think Christians are more sort of aware of what disability involves, more aware of how to be sensitive towards that, and the kind of language and stuff that we do towards you know, when it comes to offering prayer or whatever it might be?
Well, I remember speaking off mic to Jonathan, the healer who was in our program, and wondering why he used the word crippled a lot, you know, when he's referring to people the crippled quite a lot in my world. And in my I guess at the BBC, I think people would hesitate before calling somebody a cripple. Sorry, DB Dog.
Even the dog's objecting.
Exactly, yeah. And so, I don't know, maybe there's a language thing to go on there, but he felt, I think he was genuinely surprised, actually, when I talked to him about it. And I'd like to think that he would perhaps have a think about the language he was using, which is, again, language which is off-putting to some people. Some people would say perhaps making some parts of the church more inaccessible. I thought you were going to ask me whether I'd be blind in heaven or not.
Well, let's go there. Why not? What do you? So if you walk up at the pearly gates, do you expect to be blind, or is that something you'd like, if there is a God, for that God ultimately to heal?
Yeah, because I was going to have to give the unfortunate answer that I don't believe in heaven, everybody.
Sure. Well, we accept that from the outset, yeah, that you're not coming here with that belief. I guess the question is, if it were the case, would you want that?
I guess, and I say this in the documentary, I quite like me. I quite like the person I've become, mm-hmm, since losing my sight.
I quite like you as well.
Oh, thank you. I like you as well.
And in that sense, that disability has become part of who you are. In that sense, you don't feel that you need to be fixed, as you describe it.
The things I like, the things that excite me, the things I take pleasure from are all from a blind perspective, I suppose. I suppose I like different music, perhaps in a different way. I've come to love audiobooks, all those kind of things. People are only just now cluing into how good audiobooks are. I've been with them for donkey's years. And that's, I'm blind at the heart, I'm afraid. You kind of have to be. It's pretty... pretty overwhelming being disabled sometimes, and that's why, again, going back to that thing, that's why some people do think of themselves as disabled, not necessarily in a negative way, but because it's what their life experience is all about.
It comes back to it
all the time.
It's been just such an interesting, fascinating conversation between the three of you. Really been pleased to be able to bring it together. So, Zoe, thank you very much for coming in today. Damon as well, and Ian, who's been on the line with us. And if you want links to my guests, especially to the documentary we've been talking about, it's all available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. For the show page, today's episode, we'll have all the details and links for all of my guests, and look forward to hearing your responses too. We'll be giving the ways to get in touch in a short moment's time, but for the moment, Zoe, Ian and Damon, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let us know what you thought about the discussion today. Email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or leave me a comment via Twitter, @UnbelievableJB, on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And all of those links and links to my guests as well available from today's show at the website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. And thanks to those who have been getting in touch about last week's Israel Folau, the sacking of Israel Folau show. Israel Folau being this well-known Australian rugby star who was sacked by Rugby Australia for certain comments he'd made on Instagram. That was the subject of last week's programme. And of course, in the week since we broadcast that, there's been other interesting developments in the Israel Folau story. He launched a funding campaign for his legal challenge on GoFundMe. I think that got to around $700,000 or something before GoFundMe shut it down, saying that Israel Folau was intolerant and therefore they weren't going to give a platform for him to raise money. And his cause then got taken up by the Australian Christian Lobby, who have since, I think, in the region of over $2 million has now been raised, as many people have obviously wanted to express their support for Folau. So that's led to a whole other avalanche of tweets and blog posts and everything else about this. But people were very appreciative of the way that we carried out the discussion here on the show. It was Nick Heath, LGBT rugby commentator, alongside Lawrence Wilkinson from ADF International, talking about the controversy. This one from Adam said, "What an interesting balance and encouraging conversation about the controversy. Two great speakers from different perspectives, disagreeing well. Unbelievable continues to be the best place for thoughtful, reasoned debate between theists, atheists and agnostics." Very much appreciated that tweet, Adam. And another one from Mick that said, "Inspired by the rugby podcast, I've given the Unbelievable and Nick Heath podcast a listen. If you're looking for more debate than vitriol on the Folau sacking, give it a listen." Appreciate the sentiments. And Christine on Facebook got in touch to say, "Thanks for the debate. Great to have some insight on the issue and not just what the mainstream media are reporting or not reporting. I've recently started listening to your show on the podcast app. I'm in Australia and love how mature and gracious the debates are. Great that people are able to discuss big issues without getting personal or talking over the top of each other. Feel I've a lot to learn from your podcast in the way I discuss issues with other people. Thanks for the great show." Thank you very much. Really appreciated those words of encouragement about the show. And we will get to more of your feedback on next week's show, because we've had a lot more incoming feedback on the abortion debate as well between Ryan Christopher and Barbara Ntumi. Well, it's a pleasure to be joined on the phone now by Craig Hazen from Biola Apologetics. Craig is part of the team coming out to be with us at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2019. Only a few weeks away now, really looking forward to what is promising to be a fabulous day. Craig, along with his colleagues, Fred and Paul, are going to be here to kind of give us a masterclass, really, in apologetics, because this is what these guys do for a living. They train the people who go out and do apologetics all over the world. Craig, welcome along to the show.
Great to be with you, Justin.
I'm really looking forward to having you over in the UK very soon for this year's conference. Tell us a little bit before we get into what we're doing this year about Biola Apologetics, what you do, who you serve, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, Biola University is a 110-year-old educational institution in Los Angeles, you know, founded as a Christian school. And I know 110 years old doesn't sound old to you on the British Isles, but for those of us in Los Angeles, that's pretty old.
Uh-huh.
We tear down things so fast, we don't have anything that's 100-plus years old around. Biola's been there, and about 20 years ago, they took this crazy chance on letting me start a master's degree program in Christian apologetics. Well, you know, one of the first on the planet. And it turned out, nobody knew if it was going to go well or not, but it turned out it just boomed. We really touched a felt need. There were a lot of people who were just intellectually curious, and there are a lot of people who really needed better answers, not only for their own commitment to Christ, but to be able to respond to the skeptics and unbelievers that they bumped into every day. And so it's just been thriving for 20 years. We have a full-blown Master of Arts degree in Christian apologetics. We have anywhere from 200 to 300 graduate students at any time. And we also have a master's degree in science and religion, which is becoming very popular.
Fantastic. Are you finding, you know, in the 20 years or so now that you've established the program at Biola, that these issues are becoming ever more acute? I mean, we've called this year's conference, obviously, the theme Speaking Truth in a Post-Truth World. It feels like as much as the internet has done a lot of good for Christianity and being able to avail yourself of information, it's also a great way of spreading a lot of misinformation. And to some extent, I suppose, the task of the apologist is to try and present people with the facts.
Yes, and it used to be, you know, Christians in North America, probably in Britain too, were able to just coast along on their, you know, biblical knowledge and you know, trying to develop good theology and good Christian practices. And they didn't have to pay much attention to certain biblical teachings like be prepared always to give an answer from 1 Peter 3:15. And so they were able to ignore it simply because the culture was in some way with them. That is not the case anymore, and it's not the case in you know, all parts of the country. It's not like it's, you know, it's safe to wander around as a knowledgeless believer in Alabama or something. You just can't do it. You can't make it through the day without somebody asking you a tough question or bringing up some issue, probably because of the internet. But people just seemed a little bit more armed with questions, if not actual positions against Christianity. And so this is starting to have a real effect. So we are truly losing young people from the church. And the studies have shown, I think this is fairly definitive now, that we're losing them because they really don't believe it. They really have some questions that aren't being answered, and they're just not sure it's worth committing themselves to.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it there. There's quite a funny Babylon Bee article, this satirical Christian news website, and the headline reads, "Congregation prays graduating senior be protected from basic secular arguments they never bothered to prepare her for." It's a sort of,
you're right.
There's this idea that there is no Christian bubble, really, you can hide in anymore. You've got to be ready, as you say, to give an answer, because people are asking that these days.
Yes, it really is a kind of a gigantic information war over religious truth now. You know, it used to be that you could almost bet on the idea that if you bump into three or four people in public, you know, three or four of them are not going to know anything about any religious position. Now it seems like everybody's got at least a catchphrase or maybe a couple of arguments that they heard somewhere along the line on the internet.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you'll be speaking on. It's great that Paul Spears and Fred Sanders are both going to be joining you as part of the Biola contingent. Paul is going to be speaking on How Can I Know Christianity Is True? Building and Deploying a Reasonable Faith. And Fred will be talking about his speciality, the Trinity, and was Jesus really God? The evidence for Christ's radical claims about himself. But we've given you this this title for your plenary session, Craig, of The Truth About Jesus, Why the Good News is Way Better Than Fake News. What do you anticipate you're going to bring to us about the good news of Jesus and the fake news that's out there?
Well, I'm so glad you developed the title for me, because when I heard it, it really resonated with me. Wow, that's something I would like to talk about. I'm still kind of a wild-eyed, you know, crazy Jesus follower. I'm a convert who became a Christian as a senior in high school. You know, I was about 17 or 18, and I was like the village skeptic or agnostic at the time, and there were a lot of Christians gunning for me. And so I encounter the gospel, I give it a try, and a whole new world opens up to me. And I had a lot of questions, and they started to be answered. And I was really stunned how good the answers were. The Jesus that I was thinking existed a couple of thousand years ago wasn't the guy I discovered when I opened my heart and mind to the gospel. It just blows me away that this thing is really true. I'm not kidding. I wake up about twice a week in the morning going, oh my goodness, Christianity is true, and I'm a part of it. How did this happen? So I'm still kind of giddy with excitement over the facts of the case still, that Jesus really was a real historical figure, that he died on a Roman cross, and that the evidence is rather compelling. That he came back again in his own body on the third day, exactly as the New Testament describes. I think we can know those things to be true. And that's what I want to talk about, the kind of knowledge that we can have. Christianity makes claims about these things. And then, unlike other religions, it actually ponies up. It actually presents the evidence and lets you run with it. And I've just discovered that's just not happening in religious challengers.
Yeah. I mean, you're probably familiar with the rise of so-called Jesus mythicism, but I in a way, I was surprised when I saw about 3 years ago here in the UK, a statistic. There was a polling done by, you know, a reputable polling organization, which appeared to show nearly 40% of the general public either are not sure or do not believe that Jesus existed. And that's striking how that kind of viewpoint has obviously percolated down into general culture. And that kind of leaves Christians with a massive fight on their hands just to simply get...
Yeah,
that
really surprises me.
Yeah, the actual historical
record.
That
the number's that big. I would expect that when I go to a secular university campus. You know, I frequent those. You know, I'm probably on a campus here in the States once a month, you know, talking about something. And you know, causing a minor stir, but not a big stir. But strangely, people wonder how we can go onto secular university campuses and fare so well when we talk about religious matters. Well, it's because our opponents, those skeptics and agnostics and so on, they generally think that we, as Christians, are going to be talking about our religious feelings and our religious ideas. They have no idea that we're actually going to dig deep into philosophy and history and science and logic and whatever else we can get our hands on to really make our case, because Christianity is amenable to that. It's open to that. And so when they think we're just going to be talking about what we feel about things, they don't do much in the way of preparation. And so we tend to fare very well in these debates and dialogues on secular campuses. The evidence is there, and it's really striking.
Yeah, I always remember a story I heard. I think it was reported or caught on tape. But when you had Christopher Hitchens at Biola to debate William Lane Craig, he said words to the effect that he had been sort of slightly shocked, actually, at how much intellectual credibility there was when he'd actually dug into it. I think he was surprised at the kind of types of people and intellectual engagement he was actually encountering once he actually went out and, you know, started doing those debates and things that he did for a little while, which makes you realise the fact that there's a widespread view, as you say, that Christianity is really all about feelings, and, you know, faith is essentially something where you just sort of park your brain and just choose to believe in something imaginary. And very, I think that is the pendulum is swinging back to people starting to, you know, in the general public, realise that there's more to Christianity than that. But we've still got a long way to go, I think, before people realise, yes, Christianity is about facts, history, philosophy, science, as much as it is about, obviously, something that's experiential and emotional at the same time.
That's right. And it's not just about the hard-boiled skeptic on the secular university campus. Unfortunately, the bigger problem is probably inside the church itself. Because we haven't felt a need to focus on these things, we've let them float away. And so we haven't been giving attention to the strong evidence, the intellectual side of the faith that really grounds us. And so churches wander around thinking that they're just doing fine by, you know, encouraging young people to read their Bibles and pray and do their very best to follow Jesus, when they're getting assaulted by their friends, by their neighbors, by their coworkers, by the internet, telling them that this stuff isn't true from the get-go. So why would you consider committing yourself to it?
Mm.
So we are in those days again when we need to dust off our good arguments and some good history and find out what really happened. And that has always been our best friend. I like to use this analogy. We're like Dorothy on The Wizard of Oz. We're like Dorothy. Dorothy had the ruby slippers on all along, you know. She had what it took to get her home. And we've got that in the church, too. We've done wonderful work in Christian philosophy and biblical studies and theology and apologetics. And we just need to dust that off and train the people in the church to use that. It'll make a huge difference in the people's faith and in how skeptics interact with us.
Mm. Yeah, thank you so much. We're really looking forward to you being there, Craig, as I say, along with the rest of the team from Biola.
Yeah, my pleasure. And by the way, you're going to really love Dr. Paul Spears and Dr. Fred Sanders. They are wonderful thinkers and speakers, and I can't wait to introduce them to the crowds in London.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, all the very best, and we will see you soon. And a reminder to anyone who's listening and hasn't yet to get themselves booked in, this is your chance to do so. It's not just Craig and the team from Biola, loads of other speakers on the bill for this year, loads of great topics that you will want to dig into. Do get along to the website, get yourself booked in, bring a group from your church. There's a great group deal on the website as well at the moment. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievableconference. But until we meet again in London, Craig, thank you very much for being on the show today.
All right, can't wait to see you.
You're unbelievable.
Thanks for being with me on the show today. The Profile is here next. I'm sitting down with Pete Portal to talk about his journey of finding Jesus in a Cape Town ghetto. On next week's programme, come back for questions that young people are asking. That's one of the themes that we'll be looking at this year's Unbelievable Conference. What are the real questions our teenagers are asking? Well, we've been out and asked some of them, and you'll hear them on next week's edition of the programme, as I'm joined by David Robertson, apologist, and atheist Hannah Timpson, as they respond as an atheist and a Christian to the questions that young people have. Hope you can join me for that special edition of the programme, same time next week. Until then, have a good week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.